This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
But we're not fighting for us, just for the people back home.
Purple Heart Warriors. Listen now by searching for Dramas wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the World Service of the BBC, coming live from London. This is Owen Bennett-Jones. Now, German officials say the man accused of driving into crowds at a Christmas market in Magdeburg is Talab al-Abdulmohsen, a 50-year-old Saudi doctor living in Germany since 2006. He has a track record of being very critical of Islam. He killed five people. It's not clear why. He is alive and under arrest, so maybe that will become clear at some point. And certainly, Chancellor Olaf Scholz has said the investigation will be thorough.
No stone must be left unturned in this investigation, and that is how it will be. We have all assured each other of this. The federal government with the state, with all those who have responsibility at a local level here. And of course, we must understand the perpetrator, his actions, his motives, so that we can respond with the necessary criminal and other procedures. And we will.
As you can imagine, the memorial service was held this evening in Magdeburg for victims of the attack. And people attending that service said they were deeply shocked.
You can't put it into words and understand it yourself. That's why we are here, to try to understand it and to express our sympathy to the relatives who have now lost these five people, these five lives.
I have heard from many who happened to be there, who narrowly escaped the whole thing, who are lying in bed in hospital, distant acquaintances and good friends, work colleagues. It's terrible.
It's a deep scar. And we have to be together, despite everything, and we have to try to hold back what could be made of it. And we should probably all be there today to show that we're standing together with compassion and that we are united.
Well, we're joined now by Bethany Bell, our correspondent, who's in Magdeburg and trying to work out what on earth happened here. I mean, Bethany Bell, I gave the bare facts about this man, 50-year-old Saudi doctor. Is any more details coming out about him?
We heard earlier on this afternoon from police and prosecutors. He was a psychiatrist who worked at a specialised clinic at a town not far from Magdeburg and had worked there, we understand, since 2020. The clinic put out a statement today saying that he hadn't been working since October because of sickness and holiday. Why he may have done this is at the bottom of all the questions now that the prosecution is trying to ask. One suggestion that came from the prosecution today, a line of inquiry that they're following, is: was he angry at the way that Saudi refugees in Germany were being treated? This is one thing that's being looked at. But as you say, so far it appears he was quite anti-Islamic. The Germany's interior minister, Nancy Faeser, said that was the one thing she could confirm, and that everything else was subject to investigation.
Yeah, anti-Islamic, but maybe also sort of anti the police or anti the authorities in some way. The police are saying he, from what they know, he was doing this alone.
That is what they have told us so far. The investigations are continuing, yes, but the understanding is that he was operating alone.
Yeah. Now then, all the politicians, as they always do in these situations, say we must be united in the face of this kind of attack. From what you're seeing of the reactions and the political reactions, I guess, is there unity?
So far tonight, we have just had this huge memorial service in the magnificent Gothic cathedral here in Magdeburg. It was attended by Germany's president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier. Chancellor Olaf Scholz was there along with relatives and rescue workers, and hundreds of people gathered outside in the square outside. I was among them. It was raining. There were people there telling me they felt it was important to come specifically to stand there tonight to show solidarity, to show that the community mattered. Not very far away, we understand there was a demonstration where far-right slogans were shouted, where there was a lot of anger. And we know that Chancellor Olaf Scholz was heckled earlier on today. So it's a mixed picture and emotions are running high.
Unity up to a point. Bethany Bell, thank you very much. Well, I spoke earlier to Nicole Anger, who's a member of the State Parliament for Die Linke, the left party in Saxony-Anhalt. This is where this happened, so she's a representative basically for Magdeburg. She lives just around the corner from the market where this happened, and actually someone she knew was there when it happened.
My friend was working in one of the market stalls there last night when he suddenly heard a loud bang and everybody started to scream and to run, and the people were really terrified. So they closed the stall and left the market, and he was very much afraid. So he called and asked if there's someone around and they can come to talk and to sit together and spend the evening together. And that's what we did last night, and watched the news and got all the information we could get about the situation here in Magdeburg.
Because these Christmas markets, they're in many, many cities, and I guess that's probably the busiest time when this happened in the evening, isn't it?
Indeed, it is. It was Friday night, so everybody was looking forward to go into the weekend, wanted to spend time with family and friends on the market, have some drinks, some food, some talk, and just having a good time with lots of joy.
Yeah, so this is obviously going to make a massive impact on Magdeburg. You represent the area. You'll be thinking about this for the whole of the next year.
We are not that far at the moment. Shock is immense, is massive, so we just have a look at the situation now that all the people who were injured, who are looking for relatives, are fine now, and then we have to think about the next year.
What are you learning about the man who did this?
We already know that he is a 50-year-old guy from Saudi nation, and he worked here as a doctor for psychiatry. He's in Germany for about 18 years by the time. He should have been living in Magdeburg as well, but moved away about 40 kilometers far from here. And he is a supporter of the right-wing extremists.
That was Nicole Anger, who's a member of the State Parliament for Die Linke, just referring there to the fact there are some suggestions in his online messaging that he was sympathetic to the far right in Germany. Well, earlier I heard from Dr. Hans Jakob Schindler, formerly the senior director at the Counter-Extremism Project in Berlin. Any idea about the motive?
It is very hard. The best guesstimate that you can make, looking at what he has been communicating over the last couple of years, is that he really belongs into this conspiratorial narrative category of extremists, which had been growing quite significantly since the corona epidemic, and social media companies are really not doing anything against those people. They are not quite effective in preventing Islamist terrorism content, which they know best, but conspiratorial narratives such as this, especially individualized conspiratorial narratives, because he also felt personally persecuted by the German police, is something that these companies simply don't look at. And the German security forces neither have the legal mandate nor the resources to monitor the entire internet all the time.
Yeah, but I mean, even if you had monitored the internet and seen his conspiracy theories, you wouldn't think they would lead to a violent act like this, would you?
Well, not necessarily, but he did say he is going to do an attack. He did say he's going to take revenge. So there were clear formulations. But the problem is, and this is going to be always a difficult thing of assessment for the security forces to go over, unfortunately, because the big social media companies, in this case X, where all of this material is, have not gotten better, but they reduced their content monitoring capabilities and investments, You have so much hatred and so many fantasies of violence on the internet that it's really hard to distinguish what is just a person that is disturbed and just lives disturbed ideas out on the internet, and which one of those is a person that then gets into a car and plows through a Christmas market.
Yeah, I mean, you were with the Counter-Extremism Project in Berlin, and I guess we're broadening this out now, but what you're really saying is that the social media companies need to do a lot more to control the content that's going out on their platforms.
Well, more precisely, I would say they should do something. They are worse than they were a couple of years ago, because they have understood that there are no consequences for not doing anything. I mean, the French had to arrest the CEO of Telegram to get cooperation for the law enforcement on child pornography from Telegram. This is the state where we are. So we haven't developed into a positive direction. We've reversed, unfortunately, the last couple of years.
I take your point that there were some worrying signs online. But nonetheless, it is unusual, isn't it, to have a conspiracy theorist. I mean, there are so many conspiracy theorists now, but they don't normally, unless they're backed by a major ideology of some kind, they don't go to violence. I mean, I can't think of another case where someone who just believes a whole lot of crazy things goes to this extent.
Yes and no. Of course, we did have an attempted coup d'etat by conspiracy theorists about 2 years ago. So there is some experience of violence from that milieu. There's even a special category now called the delegitimizers by the German security services, because you have this salad bar of weird and weirder ideological narratives that people adhere to, always anti-state, anti-government, anti-police. And there has been attempts to conduct violence quite frequently, especially since the corona pandemic in Germany. So this threat is a new threat, but it's still very unknown. And this particular individual was a very strange subcategory of a subcategory.
Exactly.
And that's why likely he wasn't really realized as one who would be dangerous.
Yeah, but just listening to you there, basically he was anti-system. Is that the sort of broad category you could put him in?
That is the most fitting category when you say the police prosecutes me individually because I'm a critic of Islam and Germany as a society and the police are attempting to Islamicize Europe. That is the kind of conspiracy narrative that denies the legitimacy of the system. That's the best fit. But he remains a very weird character.
When you take these kind of arguments you're expressing to us to the authorities in Germany, do they listen?
Of course they do. But we in Germany are very strict when it comes to data protection for good historical reasons. We had two versions of a dictatorship in Germany, a brown one and a red one. So there is always a very strict legal corset for anything that has to do with large data analysis for the security forces. Hence, they don't have the legal mandate to do that. And then because of that, they don't have the technology that would allow them to do that, nor do they have the personnel. So it really is always run against the clock on the security forces side to get a handle on this. And they would need, more than anyone else, the help of these companies.
And that was Hans Jakob Schindler, who is formerly with the Counter-Extremism Project in Berlin. And coming up on the programme, we'll be hearing about celebrating the ancient midwinter Persian festival of Yalda.
Yalda comes from Syriac and means birth. And it's the idea of the birth of the sun or the birth of the light in the darkest part of the year. And therefore, metaphorically, better times.
Happens on the longest night, as we'll be hearing. Some headlines. A memorial service has been taking place in Magdeburg in central Germany for the victims of a deadly attack on a Christmas market on Friday. There have been two more cases in Nigeria of people being crushed to death at events where free food was being distributed. And Hamas and two other Palestinian militant groups have said that a Gaza ceasefire deal with Israel is closer than ever if Israel doesn't impose new conditions. Ten years ago, the ultra-Orthodox Jewish Lev Tahor sect left Canada amid allegations of child abuse, and it seems they, or a group very like them, may have set up instead in Guatemala, where the authorities have just said they've rescued 160 children from a farm that was being used by the sect. Now, prosecutors are saying there were suspicions of forced pregnancy, mistreatment of minors and rape. The Left Tahor sect accused the Guatemalan authorities in turn of religious persecution. Well, Jody Garcia is a freelance journalist from Guatemala. I asked her to tell us more about the group.
They come from Canada, the US, and some of the people are also from Israel. They established a community near to Atitlan Lake, and they start to have problems with the community that rejected the things that they used to do, like live in areas with gates, not allowing the children or the woman to communicate with anyone else. So then they start to move, and right now they live in Santa Rosa, in a gated community near to the border with El Salvador. Some of the children and women escaped and ran to the police to present like legal complaints about treatments that they were receiving inside the community.
Can you tell us more about what kind of treatment these women and children were experiencing?
The authorities raided the place because they have information that these people were suffering from human trafficking. For example, marriage between underage kids, also pregnancy without the consent of the children. Now, what the authorities did yesterday was to rescue around 160 children and teenagers that might have been victims of human trafficking and other crimes. And they detained one police accused that he might be leaking information to Lev Tahor to let them know that the authorities were trying to investigate them.
Were these children Jewish children from the community? Were they brought in from other countries?
The information available right now is that some of the nationalities are Canada and the United States, and they were brought in here to Guatemala, in some cases with the consent of the parents that were part already of the community.
And this is a religious outfit, is it?
It's mainly religious. They say to the authorities that they study the Bible, they want to live by their own rules, like children don't go to school, they are educated inside of this farm. The woman and children are totally covered with clothes.
It sounds like a cult. Do you know how many people were there?
Yeah, sounds like a cult. And according to the authorities, it's about 500 people that live in this area, and 160 were underage.
There's someone, a special prosecutor, saying that officers found bodies that had been buried there.
Yes, yes. Yesterday, the prosecutor informed that they have a dog there, and they found a cage with a body. The suspicious is that it's an underage or a baby. We spoke with some of the authorities, and they were explaining that they received information that some of the teenagers died giving birth, and sometimes the bodies were buried inside the farm. Yesterday, the U.S. community in Guatemala released a statement saying that they take distance from Lev Tahor. Yeah. They don't have anything to do with them, and they say that they will help if they can afford something.
So it sounds like this group will now be broken up.
Right now, the investigation is ongoing. Actually, the raid ended last night almost at 11 p.m. So in the prosecutors mentioned that all these crimes might be committed by one person of the community, one leader. But at the moment, they haven't been detained.
And that was Jody Garcia. Now, in the midst of the scramble for a new Syria, the country's musicians are watching the new government closely. You might think that the recent years of conflict would mean there had been little time for music, but actually there was a steady beat of underground heavy metal and electronic dance music. But what now? Well, the BBC's Barbara Pledusher has been speaking to musicians and fans in Damascus.
Syrian metal is war. That's the title of this documentary on an underground music scene that found energy and focus as the country was consumed with conflict. Nail al-Hadidi sold heavy metal cassettes in his music store some 20 years ago as local bands began to form. They operated in the shadows because the rebellious rock was forbidden.
Even if you grow hairs, going in black shirts, the security will take you. They suspect that you are satanic or something.
Satanic?
Yes. That's what happened before the war. After the war, they were too busy to dig in this way.
So in a way, the war was good for heavy metal, that it gave you more space.
Yes, I can say that, but it is not good because most of people start to leave the country. 90% of my friends now in Europe, in Netherlands and Germany.
Wajid Kher is a musician who stayed, but he quit music when the killing started.
It seemed that any lyrics I would write, they don't express what really happened. No words can express what really happened back then.
Just last year, Wajid finally started playing and recording again, a different style of music this time. Now he's wondering what the new Islamist leadership, known as HTS, means for creative freedom.
Is there any sense that you feel you need to keep a low profile until you figure out exactly where things are going musically?
Actually, no. We have to be heard. We have to let all the people know that we are here, we exist. It's not just Islamic fronts and Islamic states here.
As we were talking, some news flashed.
We just got news that HTS had closed the Opera House.
Yeah. It's not a good sign. It's not a good indicator for anything.
We rushed to the Opera House and were told it was a false alarm. The HTS is promising to respect rights and freedoms. The square in front of the Opera House was rocking. Safana Bakley had been trying to perform songs with the choir she directs.
Well, we just wanted to gather around and sing some of our songs and sing revolutionary songs.
So you came here with members of your choir to start singing, and then these young men joined with their drums and started turning
it
into...
Well, actually, it's our drum.
Oh, is it your drum?
Yes. We just gave it to them because they are so enthusiastic about using it.
Eventually, Safana managed to get some kind of order into the celebration. But it's electronic music that led the resurgence of Syria's nightlife over the past few years, with big dance parties in historic locations. DJ Maher Green is one of the musicians involved. He says people in the industry are preparing to approach the Islamist government.
It doesn't seem like in the first week of freeing Syria, they are willing to look for the cultural side. They have a lot of problems, other problems to look for. We are trying to organize ourselves before they are looking for the culture, so we get there first.
Like others here, Maher has been experimenting, mixing traditional Arabic music with electronic beats. He's wary about the conservative views of the rebels.
The culture is religious songs, religious melodies, and that's it. This is a little bit a backward for us. During the war, we have so much experiments, we have so much involved, we have so much mixed culture.
Syria's music scene has revived and even thrived during the civil war. Now it faces a new and unexpected test.
Hearing from those musicians in Damascus, that was Barbara Plett Usher. You're listening to the World Service of the BBC.
You are bound to devote yourself to the long conflict between the light and the dark.
The dark is rising. An immersive audio adventure adapting Susan Cooper's classic fantasy novel into a gripping 12-part family drama.
Everything had changed.
The dark is rising. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is NewsHour, and for many Iranians, today was a day of yawns, because last night was Yalda night. That is the day of the longest night of the year in the Northern Hemisphere, and celebrated by Iranians such as Dominic Parviz, who's Professor of Persian Literature and Iranian Culture in Oxford. What did he get up to on Yalda night?
We, as a family together, did what most people do, which is eat various types of fruit, particularly pomegranate, watermelon as well, And my in-laws ate persimmons. And then I made a dish which is called fesenjun, made with walnuts and pomegranate and either duck or chicken.
And people all over the world doing this. And interestingly, not just in Iran, but further afield in that region, in even in India, Pakistan, Kashmir.
Definitely. I mean, the Persianate world, as some people call it, has really a reach that goes both westwards from modern Iran, but certainly into Afghanistan and Central Asia, and as you say, into what is now Pakistan and northern India.
So someone in Kabul would have been doing a sort of recognizable thing to you in Michigan.
Yes, something similar. And certainly having the same kind of understanding of the significance of this being the longest, the darkest night of the year, and hoping for and expecting the coming of longer days and the birth, in a way. Yalda comes from Syriac and means birth. And it's the idea of the birth of the sun or the birth of the light in the darkest part of the year, and therefore metaphorically better times.
Am I right in thinking Yalda hardliners actually stay up all night until dawn?
They do, yes. But it is something that, of course, starts with feasting and music, and poetry reading is really important, particularly the poetry of Hafez, who lived in the 14th century in Shiraz.
Can you treat us to some Hafez?
Let us scatter roses and pour red wine into the cup. Let's shatter heaven's roof and form a novel design. Since you have a fine lute in your hand, musician, play a sweet tune so that we might dance and sing poems, stamp our feet and swing our heads.
Well, this is pre-Islamic. If you're in Iran with the government there, are they supportive of this as part of Iranian culture? Are they hostile to it as religiously not quite right?
It's a good question. I mean, Shabi Yalda, this celebration is something that people do in their homes, with their families, with their closest friends. And of course, the private sphere is quite different to the public sphere in Iran for various reasons, as you pointed out. I wouldn't say they were necessarily very opposed to it in principle, but it is something that, because of its ancient nature, like the Persian New Year, Nowruz, in March, is something that appeals across the board to Iranians, Iranians of all religions or no religion, Iranians of various political persuasions. So it's something that's very kind of unifying to Iranians inside and outside of Iran.
And that was Dominic Parviz, the professor of Persian literature and Iranian culture at Oxford. Pakistan's foreign ministry has dismissed as irrational a senior American security official's suggestion that its missile program could pose a threat to the United States. The US Deputy National Security Advisor John Finer said that Pakistan's development of long-range ballistic missiles capable of striking targets well beyond South Asia, together with its possession of nuclear weapons, could present an emerging threat to the USA. Well, Mumtaz Baloch is the spokesperson for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Pakistan. Why is the US wrong to see these missiles as a threat?
Recent decision by the United States to sanction a Pakistani defense entity and the reasoning behind this is unreasonable and unfounded. Pakistan's missile program is a modest program. It is not targeted against any country. It is defensive in nature. And very important to understand is that Pakistan and the United States have very good relations. And Pakistan has never, ever threatened the United States or expressed any desire to sever this relationship. So such unilateral measures defy logic and not conducive to peace and security in South Asia.
I mean, you say there have always been wonderful relations between Pakistan and the US, but the fact is that there were lots in your military establishment who were celebrating the defeat of the US in Afghanistan. I mean, that's hardly the behaviour of a close ally and friend, is it?
The withdrawal of United States from Afghanistan was precipitous. And when they left heavy military equipment, that is now in the hands of terrorists, which continue to threaten Pakistan's security. So we also have many issues and complaints about the process of withdrawal. And it is important for both Pakistan and the United States to resolve any issues that arise through dialogue. And we expect and hope that the United States will contribute to peace and security in South Asia.
In your stint as the Pakistani Foreign Ministry spokesperson, you've always asserted that Pakistan is a proud sovereign nation. Will you take retaliatory sanctions against the US?
Well, Pakistan and the United States, we again, as I said, we believe in dialogue, we believe in constructive engagement, and we believe that we can resolve issues through diplomacy.
Now then, just on this statement that the Foreign Ministry has issued about this, there's lots of vague talk about, you know, people across the border in the east and a difficult neighbourhood and that sort of thing. Why don't you just spell it out and say that these weapons are to deter Indian attack? Why does Pakistan hesitate to say that?
Pakistan has never hesitated to say that. Pakistan has always said that our missile program is defensive in nature and it is for peace and stability in South Asia. We do not have any designs against anyone. And the idea that a modest missile program of a friendly country in South Asia could somehow endanger the security of a superpower defies logic. And it also calls into question the credibility of the standards by which these unilateral sanctions are imposed.
Just to be clear, you're saying that the Americans haven't done anything like this against India, right?
That is a fact that everybody who is following developments in South Asia knows. India is developing its long-range as well as hypersonic delivery means without any objections or concern that could have been raised by big powers, including from the United States. And Pakistan has expressed this concern in the past. And this is, we believe, is a biased approach. These are double standards, which are not conducive for peace and security in South Asia.
And that was the Pakistani Foreign Ministry spokesperson there, Mumtaz Baloch. You're listening to NewsHour. Since Ukraine, the invasion of Ukraine by Russia in 2022, there have been people in the US making donations to support Ukrainians. And in the beginning, the support that was on offer was pretty overwhelming. But there are now signs that well away from the front lines, war weariness is setting in. The BBC's Christina Volk reports.
In the city of Chernivtsi in West Ukraine, children open presents as their mothers watch in the background. Two young boys play with new footballs, while a girl in a knitted jumper smiles and holds up a doll with a big red bow in her hair. They have all lost a parent in the war. The presents were organized by a group of US volunteers who have been collecting donations since the beginning of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Some of those donations are organized by the owner of Veselka, a restaurant in New York. Jason Burchard's grandparents fled Ukraine after the Second World War and became refugees in the US. When Russia's invasion began, Veselka quickly became the hub for New York's Ukrainian diaspora to organize help. But as the war has dragged on, Jason says donations are starting to dry up.
It's been a bit challenging, to be honest. They trickle in, but not as, you know, on the grandest scale as they once were. You know, as we enter year three, people are very war weary and are not sure of what the future holds.
In Ukraine, Shana Galeyeva is distributing presents and other vital items like medical supplies with her charity, Bird of Light. Since the beginning of the war, she says, the charity has raised $5.8 million, mainly focusing on supporting children who have lost parents in the war.
These children writing letters to St. Nicholas, which is like a Ukrainian Santa Claus. Every single child writes, "My dream is for the war to be over so that we can all live and play with our friends. And then they become practical and they ask for things from soccer uniforms to like toys or makeup kits.
Kira is one of the children that received a present this year. Her father went missing in the eastern Donbas region, which Russian forces are desperately trying to seize.
When this gift came, I was very happy. I wanted it for a long time. But still, when I think about the way it came to me, the price I had to pay for it, I am ready to give everything back, just to have my father returned. My dad was the one who would always give me advice. And now, without him, I don't know what to do.
It's not just donations for Ukraine that are drying up. U.S. government support might also now be in doubt. Giuseppe Irto is from the German Kiel Institute for the World Economy. They track U.S. government assistance to Ukraine.
The U.S. in particular is the most significant donor of aid to Ukraine since the beginning of the conflict.
Incoming President Donald Trump has previously criticized the amount the U.S. is spending on military support for Ukraine. It's not clear if, or by how much, another support package will be approved. Ukrainians like Shana now live with the uncertainty of new U.S. leadership.
I believe in humanity, although it's getting harder and harder. But I want to believe that this year, 2025, is going to be the year when kindness and goodness will prevail.
And that was a report by Christina Volk. Now, Qatar has just reopened its embassy in Damascus. That's 13 years after it was closed at the start of the Syrian civil war. Now, other Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, moved earlier. They reopened their embassies when Assad was still in power. Jane Kinnan-Mont is an expert at the European Leadership Network on the Middle East. What kind of relationship does the new administration in Syria have with the Gulf powers?
The Gulf countries a few years ago were very supportive of Syrian opposition groups. Nobody liked to say openly that they were supporting Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda group that eventually evolved into HTS, because it was designated as a terrorist organisation. But there was certainly at least private money going from various Gulf states to that group. However, over the last few years, most of the Gulf states, especially UAE and closely followed by Saudi Arabia, were trying to mend fences with the Assad regime because they thought it was here to stay. Now, everything has changed and they are starting to repair relationships and forge new relationships on a pragmatic basis with the new leaders. But there will be some resentments on the part of the Syrian opposition because they felt that most of the Gulf countries had basically dumped them and just wanted to deal with whoever was in power.
Right. And does that mean there will be a difficult relationship between HTS, the new Syrian authorities, and you know, the country with all the money, Saudi Arabia?
Not necessarily. I think that we do see a lot of pragmatism at play in the region. So Saudi Arabia was trying to normalise relations with Assad because it regards Syria as a really important country, geopolitically. Now they are going to want to work with the new people in power, regardless of their ideological stripes. And similarly, really, HTS is going to want to have a good relationship with the countries that have the economic driving seat in the region. I think it's quite clear that for the new Syrian government to succeed, the key immediate issues are going to be around the economy, getting sanctions lifted, getting capital to flow back in, finding ways for refugees to come back and contribute. So dealing with the oil-rich Gulf states is going to be critical here.
Now, let's think about Qatar as well. They've just reopened the embassy, as I said, and that means they will be looking for a role to play, presumably the role they're carving out elsewhere as a peacemaker, a mediator.
Qatar is very pleased to see the Assad regime go. They were really the last country in the region holding out against normalising with Assad. And I was in Doha, in fact, when Assad was toppled, and there was great excitement, including among the Syrian diaspora that live in Qatar. They are also very close to Turkey, which is probably going to be the most influential outside power in the new Syria. So probably we'll see Qatar and Turkey working together quite closely.
And just one last thought. When you have a weak country, foreign powers sponsor proxy forces in that country and try and gain some kind of national advantage by doing so. There must be a risk that happens in Syria now.
We've already seen that happening over the past 14 years with Russia and Iran fighting hard until recently on behalf of the Assad regime. Even since the overthrow of Assad, you've seen the US, Turkey and Israel all bombing different targets in Syria and Israel moving troops further into Syrian territory. So all of that has really underlined the fears that Syrians have of, you know, further fueling of conflict.
And that was Jane Kinnamont from the European Leadership Network. War crimes trials are always subject to the criticism that they amount to victor's justice. At the same time, those involved in various post-conflict judicial processes point out that in war, crimes are often committed and perpetrators should be held to account. It is a feature of modern conflict that activists start gathering evidence of war crimes in real time as they're happening, and that's what's been going on in Syria in recent years. And one man who's just been there to investigate is Stephen Rapp. Now, he's an American lawyer, academic and former Democratic congressman who served as the US ambassador at large for war crimes under President Obama. He currently chairs the Commission for International Justice and Accountability Board of Commissioners. Now, he joined us earlier from Washington, and I asked him how long he'd stayed in Syria.
Just about 4 days, Monday through Thursday of this week.
Right. And what did you see?
Well, I saw enormous exhilaration, Syrians cheering in the streets, a smile on every face, places that people couldn't go to, parks and high lookouts above the city occupied by whole families, rejoicing that this dictatorship of 54 years has ended. And then, of course, I saw the dungeons in which really tens of thousands of people were tortured to death, surrounded by families seeking any documentation, any information about what happened to their loved ones. I saw two of the mass graves that we had identified from satellite imagery and from insider testimony of those that dug the graves and saw their bones and evidence that what we feared indeed did happen.
And that was mass graves that were being used by the regime, right, by the government, not any of the other groups in Syria.
No, used by the regimes. Of course, we had in the Caesar photos, photos that were smuggled out by a Syrian military police photographer, images of at least 7,000 specific individuals that had been tortured to death in five regime facilities during 2012 and 2013. We've had another individual who came out in 2017 that was the supervisor of at least the first two mass graves and described those bodies and then, of course, bodies to follow in 14, 15, 16, 17 being brought to those cemeteries, at least twice a week in refrigerated trucks, badly decomposed bodies and buried after the digging of trenches that were about 5 meters deep.
Yeah, it sounds absolutely horrendous. Now, Bashar al-Assad is in Moscow. He presumably, therefore, will not be brought to justice.
Well, lots of people have thought they could get away with these crimes, and we should never say never. Milosevic and Charles Taylor and Ratko Mladic and Karadzic and others thought they would escape justice, and eventually the pressures were brought, and countries found it in their political interest to surrender these butchers to face justice, to face the victims and survivors of their crimes.
Should it just be the leaders who are held to account, or those who will doubtless say they were just following orders?
Well, following orders isn't an excuse, but one had in Syria a system of state terror where if you didn't participate, you too would soon be in one of those mass graves. The interim authorities have recognized that in the sense that they've once said they have no interest in prosecuting conscripts, drafted soldiers, and have already released those individuals and ordered their forces to do nothing to harm them. And I understand from a number of instances those orders are being followed. And I think that's appropriate. To be frank, the number of people that could be prosecuted is I suppose, in the tens of thousands. But my focus in most of the situations that we've dealt with is to deal with the major leaders, the ones that really made it happen, and to make sure that they're quality trials with due process and respect for human rights and proper defense and participation of victims and all of that. And then develop other ways to establish the truth about the bigger picture and what truly happened, and to either have a commission to do that or some kind of a reporting mechanism under which documents are released and information is provided.
Yeah, you just sort of mentioned some of the big names from the former Yugoslav conflict and the justice system that was introduced for that. Is the evidence in this Syrian case worse, equal, or better than what you had for that one?
Well, it is frankly much, much better, in part because this regime was extremely bureaucratic and had multiple organs all working together in this, almost competitively in it, and they communicated back and forth. A non-governmental group that I now head, the CIJA, Commission for International Justice and Accountability, had brought with Syrian participants and employees and staff, more than 1.3 million pages out of Syria, often material on meetings in Damascus that we found in Aleppo. But of course, now when we actually get to the sort of the belly of the beast, we find 10 times that many documents. So, of course, some of them are being pilfered. In the case in the Palestine branch 235, the main evidence room has been burned up. Some is lost, but so much is communicated back and forth that as long as security is maintained of these facilities, I think it will be possible to basically fill in the whole picture. And indeed, that picture has already revealed a campaign of mass terror, torture, disappearance, etc., that's killed at least 100,000 Syrians.
Now, the new authorities in Syria have so much to worry about, so much to do. I mean, this issue's no doubt there, but there will be many other priorities. How much priority do you think it should be given versus other issues? And do you think their terrorist designation is a problem in that it, you know, reduce the amount of international cooperation they want to do?
Well, I met on Thursday, the day before Assistant Secretary Leaf met with members of the government. I met on Thursday before I left Damascus with essentially the acting foreign minister, who indicated that this was a very, very high priority for them. I have certain things that I think they need to do in terms of the kind of three steps here, in terms of the documentation, in terms of the mass graves, and then in terms of sort of developing the beginnings of a structure for a judiciary to handle these major cases. There's no question that the sanctions do create an obstacle for organizations even like the CIJA, which is supported by a variety of government's donations, and those donations might be held up if we're participating in it with a designated terrorist organization.
And that was Stephen Rapp, U.S. lawyer, academic, and formerly Democratic congressman. And he brings us to an end of this edition of NewsHour. So thanks for listening, and from Owen Bennett-Jones here in London, goodbye.
Devote yourself to the long conflict between the light and the dark.
The Dark is Rising, an immersive audio adventure adapting Susan Cooper's classic fantasy novel into a gripping 12-part family drama.
Everything had changed.
The Dark is Rising. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.